hammer.
I'm seeking representation.
The jaded lawyer with no respect for the law.
Innocent people can't afford me.
The truth stays with us.
Would you accept a client if you were constantly thinking, I don't want this person to touch me?
I have a case.
There's nothing to prove he did anything.
In this country.
You do not speak. Your job is just to sit there and look innocent.
Do you have any other questions for me, counselor?
I had a job in a defense plant. I could have taken a deferment.
Sir, I know the law, and I know my son is protected by those laws. They're framed in our Constitution.
Your Honor, I'd like to ask for a recess.
I'd like an answer to the question, Judge.
The court will wait for an answer.
Welcome back to another episode of The Hammer. I'm Dan Simrell here with Peter Paul Olszewski, who is an attorney, a former district attorney in Luzerne County, and a former judge in Luzerne County. And today we are talking about the absolutely riveting case of Michael Bardo. Peter, can you just kind of bring us back to and set the stage for us, the date at which all of this started to unfold, and give us a little background on Michael Bardo's case?
Sure. This situation began to unfold on September the 3rd of 1992 in the city of Wilkes-Barre. A three-year-old girl by the name of Joelle Donovan was found to be missing from her home on Barney Street in the city of Wilkes-Barre. Initially, relatives of hers, both a grandmother, an aunt, and her mother, looked throughout the double block home, and Joelle couldn't be found anywhere. That was about 5 in the morning. By 6:30, they were frantic, and they awoke other members of the family to assist in looking for Joelle in the immediate surroundings of the home down in South Wilkes-Barre, to no avail. So about 8 a.m. that morning, the family called the Wilkes-Barre City Police Department and reported Joelle missing. That triggered a huge search done by not only the city of Wilkes-Barre's police department, but by neighbors, friends, family, volunteers from throughout Wilkes-Barre and candidly throughout Luzerne County. One of those people who agreed to search for Joelle was her uncle, Michael Bardo. So the search began to unfold all throughout South Wilkes-Barre. That's the area of St. Aloysius Church. To no avail on September 3rd. And it wasn't actually until the following morning, so about 24 hours later, that one of the volunteers went back down into Solomon's Creek. Solomon's Creek flows through South Wilkes-Barre. There's a number of bridges that cross it. One of those bridges is over Barney Street. And so this particular volunteer went back there, and although that area had been searched the day before, he saw in the running water and the mud of the creek, he noticed what looked like a green trash bag, plastic trash bag that was covered with mud, partially covered with water. And when he focused his full attention to it, what he told the Wilkes-Barre City Police Department is that he saw what he thought looked like small fingers protruding from the green garbage bag. And indeed, the garbage bag contained the lifeless body of three-year-old Joelle Donovan.
Wow. Now, you're the district attorney at the time.
I was the district attorney at the time.
And are you made aware, you're made aware of this case as it's unfolding? And
We were made aware of the case several hours after Joelle went missing. I assigned a number of county detectives to assist the Wilkes-Barre City Police Department in the search.
Along with this group of volunteers.
Correct. Right. So we were aware of it. The following morning, I got the call immediately that Joelle was found. I was at the scene. The scene was well preserved. It was photographed. It was videotaped. Mm. The way the bag was photographed and videotaped. And then ultimately, Joelle was removed to a facility that we used to conduct autopsies. And at that time, the Luzerne County coroner was Dr. George Hudak, who by profession was a pathologist, mm-hmm. who did all the county autopsies. And I actually was with Dr. Hudak witnessing the autopsy that morning. Dr. Hudak determined that the cause of death was asphyxiation. She was strangled. Hmm. He also determined and verified that Joelle was sexually assaulted prior to her death. And he determined, of course, then that the manner of death was criminal homicide.
So this, as this case evolves from a missing person to a murder case, what happens? What chain of events does that set in motion? I mean, I'm thinking that this starts when you find this poor young girl's body in a bag, correct? Like, what's going through your mind? What are you starting to think?
I could tell you that in no uncertain terms, I remember it like it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. I remember being on the Solomon, on the Barney Street Bridge. I remember looking down and seeing those fingers protruding from the bag. And I remember saying to myself, number one, we're going to determine who's responsible. And number two, I'm going to request a death penalty. Mm. And I remember that like it was yesterday. And one of the reasons that it's so vivid to me is because my one and only daughter, Rachel, was in fact 3 years old at that very same time.
Wow. Now, and as a district attorney, I'm sure you've seen a lot of gory and gruesome things in your career, but what makes this stand out because it's a child?
Well, you know, you had a three-year-old girl who is no better example of innocence than you could have. And for her life to be cut short, and the way in which it was cut short, is absolutely horrific. And it was something that not only devastated, of course, her family members, but it devastated the whole community. It devastated Luzerne County that a young infant, 3 years of age, would be so brutally sexually assaulted and then strangled to death.
So, as I mentioned before, this sets in motion a chain of events, right? As part of this investigation, what are the next steps after meeting with Dr. Hudak and determining the cause of death?
Well, initially, of course, we were all hoping to find Joelle alive under some unknown circumstance. However, actually, before she was found, detectives from the city of Wilkes-Barre, Brent Sevison in particular, and Stanley Jezeski from the DA's office, from our office, they began looking into Joelle's circumstances in life, who she lived with, where she lived, who had access to her. And very early on, when they began searching for that and determining who those individuals are, they learned that in the home that night was her uncle Michael Bardo, who had previously been convicted and spent time in a state correctional institution for sexual assault of a minor.
Oh my goodness. Was the mother aware of this?
The family was aware of the circumstances. The mother had gone out that evening, my recollection, and Joelle was left with her grandmother, I believe, who fed her, was up with her, watched TV, all the things a three, you know, a responsible adult and a child would do. They actually fell asleep on the sofa watching TV in the living room. So what transpired is then as soon as the detectives learned who Michael Barrow was and what his background was, he obviously became the focus of the investigation, particularly after Dr. Hudak confirmed the vaginal sexual assault.
Oh my goodness. So you are at this point, you're familiar with all of these details of the case. What happens next?
What we did is we planned a particular strategy on how to approach Michael Barrow for a statement. And we hoped that he would talk with us. So we consulted with two state troopers who were part of Troop N in Hazleton, who had experience with polygraphs, with the lie detector. And we had discussions with them about how to best approach Michael Barrow and who should best approach Michael Barrow and hope that he speaks to us. So we decided.
Can I just ask you a question there? Can you compel him to speak, or does he not have to speak? Or
that's a terrific question. It's a great question. I think many members of the public believe that if police approach any citizen, or approach a person, they suspect of a crime, that individual is required to speak to the police, and that's 100% not true. The police have no authority to interview somebody or to speak to somebody who declines to speak to them. And that's whether the person is in custody or not. So at this point, Michael...
You're just fingers are crossed that Michael Barrow is going to give a statement or talk.
Absolutely.
So here's another point that I want to go back to. You mentioned that, and I'm not sure if the detectives or you or your office were aware of the fact that he was one of the volunteers looking for this young girl. Did you mention that?
We learned that when the detectives interviewed Joelle's mother, grandmother, and aunt, and Michael Barrow's brother.
At this point, those two, there was you mentioned the people that were early on in the investigation that learned about his background, his criminal background. Are they now like really keeping a close eye on this guy, or was this happening while the search was going on?
My recollection is that that Michael Barrow and who he was and who his background wasn't discovered until shortly before the body was actually discovered.
Right. Okay.
And then of course we had to get Dr. Hudak. My recollection is it was a Saturday morning when her body was discovered. We had to get Dr. Hudak, get a number of people involved to conduct an autopsy as quickly as we could, and we did that. We had no idea. You know, once her body was discovered, there was no immediate evidence,
right,
that she had been sexually assaulted.
It wasn't until that autopsy.
It wasn't until the autopsy was performed that Dr. Hudak made that determination. We also didn't know, quite candidly, what the cause of death was. There didn't appear to be any, for example, no knife wound, no bullet wounds, no acute type of injury that was observable.
Right. So you needed that autopsy.
We needed the autopsy. It was critical.
In your experience, is it unusual that the perpetrator of a crime injects themselves into the post-crime scene as either a volunteer, I vaguely remember this in some movie plots where an arsonist will be at the scene of the fire, similar to this, Was that unusual, or is that unusual in your history of doing cases like this?
It's something that does happen. It's something that investigators are aware of and look for. As you mentioned, it's more often seen in arson investigations that a person who lights an arson fire is perhaps a member of the volunteer fire department and comes back to the scene to assist in extinguishing the fire. We've seen that in Luzerne County. We've seen that all over the country.
Right.
So it's out there. It certainly doesn't happen on a regular basis,
yeah,
but it's something that occurs.
I'm just trying to put myself into the mind of Michael Bardo, and am I thinking maybe I could mislead the search, or maybe I could divert people's attention from me because I'm a volunteer. I will never know at the time what he was thinking, but to me, it seems like there had to be some specific motivation to be part of this, to choose to be part of this.
I think it was certainly an attempt to distance himself from being accused. He was not interviewed by investigators prior to the autopsy. It was only after the autopsy and after we learned his background that we focused on Michael Bardo.
So you made a decision. Who did you decide to conduct the interview with him? And how did that unfold?
We had two very experienced state troopers from Troop N. Hazleton, Patty Rako, and he took charge of the interview as the lead interviewer. They approached him very delicately, very politely, not in an accusatory manner or a confrontational manner.
That was my next question, without tipping him off.
Right. He was approached from the perspective of he's one of multiple family members who was in the house, who had information,
right,
who was also being interviewed. Everybody, all the other adults were being interviewed as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it was done that this was one of many interviews that were being done to determine where and when Joel had been the prior day.
Does Michael Bardo reveal anything interesting in that first interview?
He certainly did.
Really?
Michael Bardo essentially confessed.
What?
He essentially confessed to the murder, and he made a statement. He made statements to our investigators. He was also on parole from that prior sexual that sexual conviction. So he was actually interviewed initially by his parole agent, and he gave certain information, and then we use that to try to take it further. And ultimately, what Bardo said, the gist of what he said, was that on the night in question, he was working at Burger King down there in Hanover Township by the crossroads. And he came back from work. His shift ended at 11 o'clock. He came back from work, changed his clothes, and then went out to a small bar in Hanover Township with one of his coworkers. That they were at that establishment for about 2 hours, that they jointly drank three pitchers of draft beer.
How old is Michael Bardo at this time?
Michael Bardo was in his early 30s. He was born in 1969. So no, he would have been in his mid-20s. Born in 69, 89, 20. Yeah, so in mid-20s.
So working at Burger King isn't unusual for where he's at in his life?
No, not at all. And he said he came home that night and that he's...
When he says he came home to where Joel
was not living in that home. That was not her permanent residence. She was staying with those relatives
All right.
Because her mother had some kind of plans, and the the grandmother and an aunt had agreed to watch Joel.
All right. But Michael was staying in, was living in that.
That was his residence.
All right.
Yes.
That clarifies.
Absolutely. So he came home, and when he walked in, he said he saw Joel sleeping on the sofa in front of the TV in the living room, that he sat down next to her for a short period of time, that he then went into the kitchen, and that he got something to eat and came back. He came back into the living room. Joel was still asleep. He sat next to her.
Is the grandmother still in the same?
No, grandmother then I think had left Joel on that couch, and the grandmother then went to her bed.
Okay, all right.
And that he sat on the couch next to Joel, and his initial statement, he tried to downplay it. He said that he was rubbing her butt, and then he admitted to, he claimed he touched her vaginal area, and that Joel screamed and jumped in response to that, and that he put his hand over her mouth for a short time, and she quieted down. He went back into the kitchen for some time, and then when he returned again to the living room, he saw that Joel was not moving and that she was dead.
Wow. Wow. So this is his version, obviously.
That was his version initially. He then added, after some time, the investigators continued another interview.
Let me just ask a question here. How much did the investigators know? Did they know all the full details of the autopsy?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So they're just going, they're doing their due diligence. They're taking him through this interview, still probably being cautious.
They knew the investigators who were interviewing Michael Bardo were aware that she had been sexually assaulted. They were aware that the cause of death was asphyxiation by manual strangulation. So they were aware of that.
So they knew she couldn't have died if he just put his hand
Correct.
Over her mouth.
Okay. They knew that.
All right.
Right.
And so you mentioned that he added something.
It then took a little while, my recollection is, and finally he what he said was that he discovered that she was dead. It was an accident that she must have died when he put his hand over her mouth, but he didn't have it there for long, and it clearly wasn't his intention to kill her. He claimed that he then panicked, and he went back into the kitchen and got a green garbage bag, a plastic garbage bag, that he put Joel into the best plastic garbage bag, that he threw the plastic bag over his shoulder and went out the door and turned left onto Barney Street and walked 1.5 blocks to the Solomon Creek Bridge, and that he threw the bag with Joel over the bridge into the creek. Oh. He then walked home and went to sleep.
Wow. What kind of person can do that without shock or remorse? What's the personality trait of Michael Bardo?
He is a sexual predator. He is a violent sexual predator of juveniles. He's heartless, and non-caring, and clearly committed the homicide to cover up the extent of the sexual assault
Wow.
The sexual assault was brutal.
Yeah. I have chills thinking about it. It is horrific to think about. So the investigators at this point, they have what they need. What happens? Do you make an arrest on the spot?
We did not make an arrest until he gave that statement. At that time,
so they didn't leave and say, "Okay, thanks for your information. Now we'll be back."
No,
they said you're under arrest.
They took him into custody
right
then and there. The complaint was signed September 5th, same day as the interview. It was signed by Detective Brent Sevenson from the Wilkes-Barre, a very experienced.
The interviewer. He was one of the interviewers.
He was one of the people, yes. Yeah. Detective Sevenson and Detective Jaszewski from my office.
Right.
Stanley was a 25-year veteran with state police prior to joining my office.
Wow.
Very experienced. So this arrest was made that evening.
All right. Now, what's happening with you? Do you get a call right away? Do they leave this interview and call you immediately?
I was there.
No, oh, you were?
I was in the building.
Okay.
I was present. Yeah.
So they brought him in to interview him.
Right. We also simultaneously then with the arrest, we're also preparing a search warrant to search his home, the home on Barney Street, and to search a couple of vehicles that were there. So I was there assisting with the preparation of the search warrant and ultimately approved the search warrants to go out into the home to see certain evidence, which they did do. They executed the warrants that night. And he was remanded. He was remanded into the Luzerne County Correctional Facility. So that's September 5th.
Yeah. So this is 2 days, within 2 days.
Within 2 days.
You're, as a district attorney, you are, and as a father of a three-year-old at the time, and had you already predetermined, you said, we're going to get who did this, and I'm going to request the death penalty. At this point, what are you thinking? What emotional state are you in?
Well, it's obviously traumatic to the detectives and to the EMS personnel and to the investigators, both at Solomon Creek and then at the autopsy, when you see what happened to a three-year-old girl and the way it happened to her.
Right.
It's obviously chilling. It's obviously emotional. For investigators who spent entire careers solving homicides, it was, just a terrible, heartbreaking experience that a young girl like this would meet her end in this way. It was difficult for everyone, but everyone, it was a total team effort. Everybody's on the same page of the playbook. Everybody's helping, doing different parts of the investigation, whether it's the interviews, whether it's the search warrants, whether it's the photographs at the autopsy, assisting Dr. Hudak in the autopsy. Of course, there was press conferences at after the autopsy.
That was my next question. When a crime this horrific involving such a young child comes out, people are clamoring for information. They want to know. And I imagine there's a fever pitch in terms of we want justice, which probably just galvanized you, I imagine, as the DA, to really make sure that this case is airtight. Could something have happened in the investigation that could have possibly jeopardized what you saw as the outcome that you wanted?
I think that one of the first things that we had to be awfully careful of, and particularly I had to be awfully careful of, is the type of statements and the type of responses I was giving to the media so as not to commit any prosecutorial misconduct and so as not to give the defendant and his counsel a later time reasons to show for a change of venue, for a change of veneer, or to show any type of undue prejudice. Because remember, the law presumes that he's innocent
until
he's proven guilty. So it's very difficult. And that was the kind of case that we would simply refer to the public document, the criminal complaint, and the affidavit that was filed, and provide that information. So that was a tough part of it. So we had to be very careful with those statements. Considerations there are then, although at the scene, I thought to myself, we're going to request the death penalty. Obviously, there has to be a legal basis to do that.
Right.
And in Pennsylvania, before a death penalty can be pursued, the DA must personally issue what's called a notice of death penalty and cite the type of aggravating circumstances that he would pursue at trial. Aggravating circumstances are the kinds of things that make this particular first-degree murder heinous, make it rise above and beyond your typical first-degree murder. And in this particular case, I cited two aggravating circumstances from our Pennsylvania statute. And one was that the killing occurred during the perpetration of a felony, which was the sexual assault of Joelle. And number two, the aggravating circumstance that the victim, Joelle Donovan, was under 12 years of age. Mm. They were the two we decided to pursue. And I also recall that there was some serious consideration on my part about also including torture. Hmm. So what we did was...
Is there a limit? Like, do you need a certain number of aggravating circumstances? Could it just be one?
You need at least one.
You need at least one, but you're not taking any chances.
So we cited two, I recall considering the torture. So we did a lot of legal research on... prior capital cases that had used torture and looked at how our Supreme Court defined that term and that aggravating circumstance. I then went and consulted with Dr. Michael Bodden from New York City, the world-renowned forensic pathologist. And we actually went to New York City. We met with Michael we talked about torture. And what he told us, which was 100% contrary to what Bardo said, was that for Joelle to be asphyxiated to death, that the defendant would have had to place his hands on the carotid arteries and on the trachea of the victim, and that constant pressure would have to be applied for 4 minutes or more.
Wow.
This is not something that happens in 30 seconds, like sometimes you see on television.
TV, right.
It took 4 minutes. That was the kind of information which I really needed, A, to get a first-degree murder conviction, mm-hmm. Then B, to impress upon the jury how he acted and how this murder was actually committed. I intentionally decided not to include torture as an aggravating circumstance.
But is your intention to have this come up in the trial?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yes. And to kind of come up in the trial and to elicit the testimony from Dr. Bodden, and then in my closing argument to the jury, to emphasize how this occurred and for a jury to realize how long 4 minutes is. So So what happened then is the arrest was September 3rd of 92, and it was September 5th, I'm sorry, of 92. And then it was on a little over 2 months later, on November 17th, that I filed the notice of death penalty.
Okay. I imagine, as always, the wheels of justice don't turn as swiftly as people would often like them to. How long before I go there, I have a side question for you. And this has to do with the investigation. When the interviewers get this information from Michael Bardo and he becomes the primary suspect and is arrested, do all other investigations or any other persons of interest, does that stop?
No, I think there's a fundamental law, criminal law, that says the Commonwealth can't convict somebody of a murder based exclusively on a confession, because the confession could be false.
Right. He could be trying to protect somebody else.
Correct.
Or take the fall for somebody else.
Right. So the investigators had to document the rest of the case.
Right.
So we documented, of course, where Joelle was that day, who she was with that evening, what happened at the house, the relatives testified.
Basically anyone who would have been in contact with her.
Correct.
That day.
Correct.
All right. I didn't mean to bring us off topic, but I always wondered that because I do hear of these strange cases where people, like a mother, will take the fall for her child, and then, you know, in many cases, the investigation just stops until something unusual pops up. But so at what point does this case come to trial?
It actually came to trial rather quickly because Bardo, because he's charged with first degree murder, bail.
Does he have an attorney? Does it just have a?
He was represented by
two
lawyers from the public defender's office.
Okay.
And because first degree murder was charged, he had no right to bail. So under those circumstances, the Commonwealth, we had 6 months, 180 days to try him.
Hmm.
So we actually, we didn't want any continuances. We wanted to go full speed ahead.
Sure.
This trial then began in January of the following year.
Wow.
So you're
like within 4 months, typically, roughly four and a half months.
Right. So the arrest was September of 92. The trial began in January of 93.
Right.
I personally tried the case. And of course,
do you have a co-counsel with you?
I did. Ingrid Cronin, who was an assistant DA in my office, was my co-counsel. And she and I were the two lawyers who represented the Commonwealth. The jury selection process in a death penalty case is long and difficult.
I'm sure.
There's a whole host of fundamental questions that have to be asked each individual juror. And
is one of those questions if they're against the death penalty?
Oh, absolutely.
So
right.
You have to have a juror that's open to the death penalty.
Right. So if a juror says that there are no circumstances under which I could sentence somebody to death, that juror is excluded.
Right, right.
So, so my recollection is that the jury selection took 5 or 6 days. Ultimately, we got the jury. And my recollection is then that the trial thereafter took about another week and a half. Ultimately, the jury went out to deliberate. The jury went out to deliberate on the guilt phase. The charges were murder of the first degree, murder of the third degree, and two counts of indecent assault.
You're jumping ahead a little bit. I have a question for you. Yeah. Paint me a picture of your opening argument. I mean, you must have been on fire. I would have been boiling over.
Well, let me even start a little bit before that. About 1 week prior to the jury selection beginning, the two lawyers representing Mr. Varro came to my office and asked to meet with me. We had a meeting, and they told me that they had, of course, been preparing for trial, and that they spoke with Mr. Varro, and that Mr. Varro instructed them to talk to me and to indicate that he was agreeable to pleading guilty to murder of the first degree and to receiving a sentence of life in prison.
In lieu of seeking the death penalty. Wow. So he knew at that point. I mean, he knew he was in deep.
He knew that things didn't look good.
Right.
I certainly don't know what those conversations were like.
Right.
But
right.
I can tell you that, so they came, they put the offer in writing. That was then a difficult decision that I had to make. And probably
because that was a sure thing. You knew he would be convicted and he'd be life. But the fact that he was coming to the table with that, saying this is what I would be amenable to, what did that make you do? Did that embolden you even more?
Well, it made me do a couple things. Number one, I had to give some considerable thought and analysis to what I believed as the prosecutor was the most appropriate sentence. And here we had a heinous murder of a young girl who, with the defendant saying, I'll plead guilty, there's no need for a trial, there's no need for the expense of going through a two-week trial. There certainly would be no appeals, there would be no further legal proceedings.
And this is before you're choosing a jury.
This was before.
And I'm sure you're thinking, jury selection is going to be tough along with this. You're weighing all of this.
We're weighing all of it. And who was the last person in Luzerne County to be sentenced to death? Well, that was George Banks for killing 13 people. As an elected public official, I also had to consider my obligation as an elected official in terms of what would happen if I turned this down and then for whatever reason, a jury, for example, found him guilty of third-degree murder.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of a life in prison, he would get 10 to 20 years.
Wow.
What would happen then? What would happen if something went terribly wrong in the trial and he was found not guilty?
Mm-hmm.
And then the public learned that
right.
I turned down a plea to first-degree life in prison.
Right. I think that's compounded by the fact that he was a prior offender who was out on parole for the same type of sexual assault. I think that's a pretty big gamble. Well, it's a gamble that is definitely notable.
But don't forget, the jury never knew of his past.
Was that unacceptable? Just, like you
just don't get to. That's not admissible evidence. So that any jury that we picked would not know that he was a prior offender. No knowledge of that.
Wow. So, well, that's interesting.
So the decision was a difficult one, and I recall talking, consulting a number of people, including DAs throughout the state, and I did not learn of a single DA who had turned down such an offer. And at the end of the decision, I thought that the way this young girl was killed, how she was killed, why she was killed, how she was put in a trash bag, thrown over her shoulder, thrown into a creek, that this was a case that warranted the death penalty, right. And I turned down the plea.
Yeah. Wow. All right, so jury selection's done. Trial is beginning. You come into this courtroom. And what is your opening argument? What's your opening statement?
My opening was really a non-emotional one in terms of I wasn't excited. I wasn't raising my voice. I was in a calm and collective manner telling the jury what they were about to see. And the hope was that in telling them what they would see, that they would recognize the seriousness of what transpired, and that they would know what their oath required of them.
I'm just thinking about how I would be feeling if I was in that jury box and hearing things just as calmly as you and I are having this conversation today.
Right.
As you are revealing the facts of this case, I can feel the emotions stirring. I can feel the emotions inside of me churning. And, you know, I haven't jumped out of my seat. I haven't been screaming here. But inside, as a parent and as a human being, I am really struggling. I don't like to watch movies where children are abducted, let alone something that happens in reality, a case. Right. That I have to make a decision on.
Right, and that was my plan. The plan was to stay calm, to be very factual, and that let their emotions and let their intellect and let their common sense guide them
through this
as
process.
They watch the trial unfold.
What was the defense strategy? I mean, you pretty much laid out what your prosecutorial strategy is. What did the defense possibly have to say?
Bartle did not testify. The defense was he didn't do it. The defense is he didn't mean to do it, and that we didn't prove, that the Commonwealth didn't prove it was a knowing, intentional, and premeditated killing.
Is that a kind of a boilerplate defense? Public defenders' duty to just bring that to the table?
Pretty much. It was that kind of defense. I think the real intent, I believe, of the defense was to save him from the death penalty.
Right, right.
I think that was their bigger job. And what I was concerned about is whether the jury would have believed Michael Bartle that he put his hand over her mouth for a short period of time, and that he didn't intend to kill her. That was the factual concern that I had about the case. But, you know, we hired Michael Bodden. He came from New York City. I called him as one of the chief Commonwealth witnesses.
Right.
He did a terrific job in explaining asphyxiation to the jury and how long it took. And then what happened is, in the closing argument, in my closing argument, I talked about 4 minutes. I talked about how long Michael Bartle had to wrap his hands around the neck, not put his hand over her mouth,
right,
but to wrap his hands around her neck with the force to totally shut off both the carotid artery and her airway. And I then got my watch, and I said, "We're going to count, and I'm gonna hold my hands."
Wow!
Like this, picturing hands around a neck for 4 minutes, and it was like an eternity.
Oh my gosh! What?
And then
could you see the look on their face? What? I mean, you're watching this, right? You're watching the jurors, or the right? You're watching the people in the box.
Right.
Are there faces changing? Are they? Is it sinking in? Is that sealing their thoughts?
Well, I certainly believe it was. I was later told by the jurors that it was very effective.
Wow.
It seemed like an eternity for me, let alone for the jurors, for them to see how long he had to keep his hands and apply that pressure. Dr. Button also testified that had he started to strangle her and cut off the artery and cut off the airway, after 2 minutes, and he released that pressure, she would have been alive.
Wow.
That she would not have died. So that was the closing.
Wow. That was a brilliant strategy.
Ultimately, the jury came back.
How long did it take them to?
It was not a lengthy period of time, about 6 hours, short period of time. That same day, they came back and convicted him of murder of the first degree and the two counts of sexual assault. The death phase began the next day.
Same jury.
And
do they have to explain to them, right? You're explaining to them how the aggravating circumstances come into play.
Well, it's interesting. That's a good question. What we did is the Commonwealth has the burden of going forward, just like in a guilt phase of the trial.
Right.
What we simply did is I stood up and I announced to the judge and to the jury that the Commonwealth is simply incorporating all the evidence that we submitted in the guilt phase as our evidence in the death phase. And then I sat down. What the defense did is they tried to establish what are called mitigating circumstances.
Right.
And they included testimony from his mother, from Bartle's mother, about his background, his school background, and his inability to read. He did testify, and he accepted responsibility and admitted to the jurors. My recollection is that he did this. They also, I believe, he told the jury that he was willing to plead guilty to first degree murder and to accept a sentence of life in prison, and that I rejected it. Also,
it's a calculated move.
Yep. And also testified that he abused alcohol, including that night.
Yeah.
So there were two aggravating circumstances and four mitigating circumstances. What the law requires is the jury then has to balance them, like on separate balancing scales.
Right.
And in this case, and to obtain a sentence of death, the jury has to be unanimous. Just like in all 12 jurors had to say guilty of first degree.
Right.
All 12 jurors had to agree.
Wow.
On these two aggravating circumstances and that they outweighed
the mitigating. So how long did they deliberate?
Well, I had to give a closing argument. I had the last word.
Right. There's a lot riding on this.
And I recall getting up and saying to the effect that this is obviously the first time I've come in front of any body of people under any circumstances and literally ask you to sentence another human being to death. And I'll also tell you that there are not many people in the history of this country who have had that responsibility.
Yeah. So you felt the weight of the situation.
Well, sure. And your responsibility is to your oath. And the oath that they took as jurors. And the oath that they took as jurors was not to consider sympathy, whether it be for Joel or for Bardo. Their obligation and their oath, their sworn obligation, was to follow the law as the judge gave it to them. And I told them that they all came in and they all answered questions. They all agreed to follow the instructions of the jury, of the judge. They did that in the guilt phase, and that I had every faith and confidence that they would do that in the sentencing phase. And my last sentence is, I respectfully request that each and every one of you follow your oaths of jurors, find that the aggravating circumstances outweigh these mitigating circumstances, and sentence Mr. Bartle to death. And I sat down.
Wow. Who was the judge in this case?
It was Judge Patrick Toole, former district attorney, president judge, terrific jurist, one of the best judges in Pennsylvania.
He had been in your shoes as a DA.
He had tried cases. I don't think he had a death penalty case, but he certainly had murder cases. He was an exceptionally talented trial lawyer.
Right. So there was no, you weren't worried about having the judge be anything but fair and
no. And he was totally fair to both sides.
Good, good. So how long before they come back, the jury?
I think it was the better part of a day.
Yeah. That's a big decision.
Right. And ultimately they came back and in fact announced that they unanimously sentenced him to death.
Wow. Now there's a little nugget of information here about this death sentence in Luzerne County. Can you share that with everyone listening?
Well, that the date they determined the death sentence was January 28th of 1993. That's 33 years from now. Mm-hmm. And no prosecutor has successfully convinced a jury to sentence any other defendant to death in Luzerne County since Michael Bardo. So I have my conviction and my death sentence of Michael Bardo was the last death sentence in Luzerne County. There have been numerous cases brought over the years.
Attempts?
Since.
Yeah.
And jurors have never brought back another death penalty. So I'm certainly, as a prosecutor, proud of the fact that that I was successful. And I think certainly proud of my decision to turn down the offer of plea to first degree with a life sentence.
Right.
And I think what I've been able to do in my career with the death penalty is quite unique. Prior to being elected DA, I reversed a death sentence for the youngest person sentenced to death in Pennsylvania, Joseph Alicio.
Mm-hmm.
Then as the DA, I successfully secured this death penalty. And then later as a judge of Luzerne County, I presided as the trial judge over 5 capital cases.
Wow.
So I think that's a rather unique experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
With death penalty.
So this is a fascinating case with many moving parts, and it's a particularly disturbing case, as I mentioned before, as a parent or even not anyone listening. Anything so heinous involving a young child is very difficult. But you were successful in trying to get the result that you knew was justice and you knew was right. What's the epilogue on Michael Bardo?
The epilogue on Michael Bardo is that he spent 20-some years, 25 years on death row, and some laws changed, and a new set of lawyers brought a post-conviction hearing act petition and presented evidence that Michael Bardo was mentally infirm.
Hmm.
And that he and his condition was one that prevented the death penalty from being executed on him.
Hmm.
And
it's my understanding that it's hard to put someone to death.
Right.
Correct.
And so ultimately there was a hearing, a lengthy hearing in front of Judge Toole, and Judge Toole concluded that the defense lawyers who represented Mr. Bardo throughout the trial were ineffective for not presenting that type of evidence. Mm. And the death penalty was was reversed and a life sentence was imposed.
So he's still in jail.
And he'll die there.
And serving a life sentence. There's no chance for parole at all for him. Wow.
He'll die there.
What an amazing part of your career to talk about. I appreciate you sharing the facts with us and this case with us. And I cannot wait for the next case that we talk about. Until then, this is Dan Simrell. You've been listening to The Hammer with the one and only attorney Peter Polaszewski, former district attorney, former Luzerne County judge. And until next time, stay safe out there.